I had been living a charmed life. My dream job as a journalist with the BBC in Britain, meeting celebrities, politicians, and fascinating people who were making their mark on the world. Then a transfer to work for China Radio International in Beijing, and a fairy tale falling in love with an American I met there. Fast forward about 30 years, and everything had changed. My eyes were so blurred with tears, I could hardly read the text on the computer screen. I was checking the final corrections to my husband's latest book. A tear dropped onto my handwritten notes and smudged the ink. Our office manager sat next to me. I blew my nose and told him I was suffering from terrible pollen allergies. It was embarrassing for both of us. Most likely, he was already aware of my husband's philandering. I reckoned I was the last one to know about it. I'd just found out from a damning text message on my husband's phone. What a cliché. It was excruciating. I'd even done a glowing foreword to his latest book, praising him as a loving husband. I'd written it after our 25th wedding anniversary, the best one ever spent in Hawaii. I felt we'd never been closer, but only a few months later, my world came crashing down when I found out about the young woman, half his age, who was his mistress. He refused to give her up. Yet I still thought my husband and I had a future together. He was the love of my life, the father of my sons. I wanted to be able to forgive him. When I called him out about the infidelity, my husband offered me a part-time wife position. "I'm perfectly capable of loving two women at once," he declared. "I'd be happy spending 2 or 3 days a week with her and the rest of the week with you." I actually considered that proposal for several months, trying to get my head around it. Could I make my husband be more appreciative and loving towards me if I agreed to him seeing her as well as me? He insisted it was just my conditioning that caused me to balk at the idea. But I worried that he wanted her for love and passion and only needed me around to do the taxes. Then I was diagnosed with breast cancer for the second time. I carried the dreaded BRCA gene that Angelina Jolie had believed could be a death sentence. While I was going through chemotherapy, my husband was in Europe with his girlfriend. Sitting in a chair at the clinic with an IV hookup in my arm, dripping chemicals into my bloodstream, I felt an aching void. It was obvious I'd never be able to stomach a part-time husband. I had to let him go. Yet, for my peace of mind, for my health, I needed to forgive both him and his girlfriend. Hanging on to resentment was draining my energy, the last thing I needed undergoing cancer treatment. I wasn't going to let my husband treat me like a doormat anymore. But I needed to truly forgive him to break the emotional hold he had on me. When we discover our partner's been cheating, it's so easy to fall into the trap of playing the blame game and plotting vengeance. Revenge is the opposite of forgiveness. Forgiveness allows us to move on and reclaim joy in our lives. The best revenge is to get past the need for it. I'll explain exactly why. I heard about a contractor who was so angry about his wife's infidelity that he filled her car with cement. Everyone laughs when I tell them that story. It's an impressive way to take revenge. But where does a couple go from there? Definitely not reconciliation, and most likely an expensive, acrimonious divorce. When you filled your former beloved's car with concrete, it becomes somewhat difficult to ask them for online passwords you can't find, such as for banking or your music collection on iTunes, or to negotiate over custody of your kids. And talking about kids, what kind of role model are you for them by treating their mom or dad that way? Revenge is toxic. It's like trying to hit someone over the head with a mallet and finding that you're actually doing that to yourself. You think you're hurting your errant spouse, but it's really you that you're hurting. I knew it would be counterproductive for me to get stuck in that kind of negativity. Instead, I wanted to spend my life energy working on the best way to move forward, so that I could thrive whether I chose to stay or go. My aim was to become a more complete, creative, and joyful person, with or without a partner. I knew this wouldn't be easy to do. We humans are emotional rather than purely rational beings. But after discovering my partner's infidelity, making spur-of-the-moment decisions based on my feelings wasn't a wise idea. I tried to wait till I'd calmed down somewhat and felt more on an even keel. I wanted to be able to carefully consider the pros and cons of whatever I planned to do. Actions that gave me the greatest benefit were paramount, rather than doing what might cause the most damage to my unfaithful partner. When my husband and I decided to end our marriage, I was fortunate that we were both level-headed enough to realize that going to divorce court would have been a monumental waste of time and money. Instead, we agreed on mediation. As a former BBC journalist, I knew that doing my research would be essential. Before going to mediation, I read 3 excellent legal self-help books on divorce published by Nolo Press: Divorce and Money, Divorce Without Court, and Divorce Over 50. They saved me from having to pay costly legal fees to find out the basics. I was glad that I didn't need any of the Nolo Press books covering child custody, as our children were already grown and no longer living with us. I've come across several spouses who were so disgusted and overwhelmed by their partner's cheating that they no longer wanted to have anything to do with their former beloved. As a result, they moved out right away and didn't even bother to claim the marital assets to which they were entitled. This was a decision they often came to sorely regret, especially if the unfaithful spouse was the higher earner. I found that the opposite scenario was equally common and more damaging to both parties concerned, where the betrayed partner would get stuck in anger and revenge, squandering marital finances on legal fees. Divorce lawyers must love vengeful clients. The more disagreements and unreasonable demands, the more money the attorneys can rake in. If husband and wife are not even on speaking terms, all requests for basic information from the other party have to go through lawyers. Ka-ching! I'm not saying you have to be best buddies with your ex-partner, but it is extremely inconvenient if you can't even talk to them on the phone. After all, one minute a partner is the love of your life, and then when you find out they've been cheating, they become an evil demon. But it's the same person, someone whom in the past you may have had a good life with and had children together. Rather than vilifying my husband, I tried to remember that he was the same flawed human being all along, with good points that originally drew me to him in the first place and bad points that made me now want to consider leaving the marriage. The subject of marital infidelity brings up all kinds of double standards. One of my close relatives, who was married and having an affair herself at the time, was quick to demonize my husband when I told her about his infidelity. She insisted his behavior was unforgivable and I should start divorce proceedings right away. hypocritical and really terrible advice. Making snap decisions based on my emotions was a lousy idea. Instead, whatever choices and actions I was considering doing, I tried to remember to first stop. Take a breath and ask myself, is this serving my own long-term best interests? Nevertheless, I can't deny that finding out the man I'd believed to be my soulmate and life partner was in love with someone else dropped me into a deep, dark pit of devastation. I'm not a marital guidance counsellor or a psychotherapist. Nevertheless, I found myself developing a 6-part program to help me get off that emotional roller coaster and stop feeling like hell. It incorporated some of the advice I received from good friends who had worked in the counselling field. I've used my program to get through both infidelity and breast cancer. It can help people cope with the emotional impact of almost any kind of adversity. The sequence of these 6 steps is arbitrary. You can work on them in any order, and like me, you may find yourself doing more than one at the same time. So, here are the 6 steps. Number 1. Find confidants and mentors. You need confidants and mentors with your best interests at heart. They could be friends or paid counselors. Try to have at least one who is of the opposite sex to you, as you might get useful insights that are very different from those of same-sex confidants. I learned that I had to choose carefully. I wanted to be able to vent my deepest, darkest feelings to people I could trust as true confidants who would keep things confidential. I couldn't do that with everyone I knew. Some of my friends would have been turned off or at least uncomfortable if I had spewed a load of negativity at them. Others were only interested in the gossip value of my breakup story, and most likely would have passed on my private, intimate details to their whole circle. Number 2. Build a community of old and new friends. Cultivate existing and new connections who are friends of your own rather than people you know through your spouse. Try to have friends of both sexes. During the course of a marriage spanning 3 decades, I realized that I had let go of most of my own close friends from my college and journalism days. One dear friend of mine from England had thought she'd done something to offend me as I hadn't responded to her emails. I was too wrapped up in taking care of my husband, the small business we owned, and my children. Almost everyone I socialized with was either a friend of my husband's or was connected to our business. It would have been very unprofessional to have discussed his infidelity with any of these people. I made it a priority to reconnect with all my old friends and to try to meet new people, both male and female. The aim was to build friendships rather than finding another relationship. I wanted to avoid rushing into a desperate rebound affair. Number 3. Laughter therapy. I made an effort to hang out with people who made me laugh rather than brought me down, and watched comedies rather than depressing dramas. Despite being a former BBC journalist, I gave up watching the news, because it's all about bad news. Good news is rarely as exciting as a tragedy. Nothing dramatic happening and everything staying hunky-dory doesn't make headlines. Growing up in Britain, I was brought up on Monty Python's Flying Circus, which helped me notice the absurd humour of my situation, whatever was happening. If you don't laugh, you cry, and I'd much rather laugh. That's why I fill the self-help books I write with cartoons and a lot of humour. There is even an Indian practice called laughter yoga to promote health and well-being. It combines yoga breathing techniques with laughter exercises. This sounds like a good idea, But I would rather laugh naturally from good conversations with entertaining people and from watching comedies without having to force anything. Number 4. Love your body and become beautiful. Here I don't mean that I tried to turn myself into a stunning supermodel. Sadly, that would be an impossible task. I'm talking more about developing internal beauty by getting enough sleep, eating well, and exercising to get healthier and banish the blues. The standard cliche in movies of a woman who's just been dumped by her man is to have her lying in bed all day, watching TV and eating ice cream from the carton. That's probably the worst thing you can do to stop feeling like hell. I found outdoor exercise, especially with friends, to be a very effective antidepressant. One friend of mine was suffering from a bout of such crippling sadness that she could barely get out of bed in the morning. I persuaded her to force herself to get up first thing and start her day spending just 15 minutes walking in nature in a local park. She told me that adding this simple routine to her life dramatically boosted her mood. Number 5. Find your passion. Work out what you're passionate about and become more of a hedonist. When I use the word hedonist, I'm not advocating irresponsible behavior that won't serve you in the long run, such as endless alcohol-fueled partying or a sex and drugs and rock and roll lifestyle. Instead, it's about making time to do things you enjoy rather than constantly keeping your nose to the grindstone. Think about what activities make your heart sing. Your passion could be art, a musical instrument, writing a book, or volunteering for a cause that you really believe in. If you've always wanted to play the saxophone in a band, I'm not recommending that you should drop your day job to try to make a living as a musician, but that you should carve out some free time to at least develop playing the instrument as a hobby. Women in particular tend to put a lot of focus on serving their families and make little time for themselves. Despite the rise of feminism, it's still a common story that working wives come home at the end of the day to cook dinner, clean up, and take care of the children, while their husbands relax in front of the TV. While we were married, my ex worked hard at his job, but never involved himself in domestic chores or child-rearing duties. After I discovered his latest affair, I came to realize that I had sublimated my entire personality into serving his needs at the expense of mine. I needed to focus on finding my passion and engaging in activities that brought me joy. For me, this was writing. I combined my background as a journalist with my love of absurd humor, and my first book, Adulterer's Wife: How to Thrive Whether You Stay or Not, was born. Number 6. Develop mindfulness. The past is gone, and the future doesn't exist. Now is all there is. So I worked at trying to live in the present and becoming more mindful, fully engaged in what I was doing right now. This was probably the most difficult of all the steps for me, and it remains a continual work in progress. Although no specific religious belief is necessary, a meditation practice and or some kind of spiritual faith can be extremely helpful to work towards achieving true mindfulness. This includes a belief in God or source from which all manifestation springs, a view shared by many of the world's great religions. Infidelity and adversity in general can create a lot of soul-searching, making us yearn to discover that there is more to life than what we have experienced up to the present moment. One benefit of dealing with life's setbacks is that they can act as a catalyst to propel us further in our spiritual development. When everything is staying the same and going fairly well, we tend not to bother to ask ourselves deep questions that lead to personal growth. Nevertheless, whether someone is atheist, agnostic, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, religious, or non-religious, learning how to become more mindful is an extremely valuable skill. Even without having to deal with adversity such as infidelity or cancer, it is very easy to spend our lives churning over the past, wishing that we had done certain things differently, and or worrying about the future, rather than being aware of what is in front of our nose in the present. In effect, we're on autopilot, missing out on enjoying the beauty of the natural surroundings we may be in, or the pleasant company we may be with, just because our minds are elsewhere. Rather than being fully alive, we're merely existing. The more mindful we are, the more fulfilled and contented our lives become. I describe this six-part program in more detail in my comic self-help book, Adulterer's Wife: How to Thrive Whether You Stay or Not. I've also put together a free mini ebook called Overcoming Infidelity: Tools to Tame the Roller Coaster of Negative Emotions. It can be downloaded by visiting my website, cjauthor.com. That's cjauthor.com, where you can find various free resources to help cope with infidelity and cancer. I include a wonderful mindfulness exercise using chocolate, which really resonates with me as I'm a lifelong chocoholic. The only thing required to do it is a wrapped piece of chocolate, which is something I always have on hand. I can't take the credit for inventing the exercise. It's been used in elementary schools in Britain to teach children how to be more mindful. So if kids can do the exercise, we adults can do it too. The bottom line is that whatever we've been through, there is always hope. I'm proof of that, as are all the people who have told their stories in this book. Many of them have overcome adversity far worse than mine. Getting cancer for the second time after I discovered my husband's infidelity showed me that I had an expiration date. Life was too short to waste on holding grudges and holding back from living the life I wanted to lead. If you feel like you're in an abyss now, just imagine how different things could be 6 months or 1 year from now, just from making the decision to put yourself first and follow the six-part plan I've described. When I was dealing with cancer on top of infidelity, doing that six-part plan was even more vital for me to retain my sanity. My infidelity mantra had been, "The best revenge is to get past the need for it." My cancer mantra was, "Information is power." I remembered what a shocking bombshell it had been when I was diagnosed with breast cancer for the first time in 2007. I had no idea what I would have to go through, but it was not going to be good. I felt like I was about to get sucked into a black hole. I couldn't say I was exactly grateful about having had a prior case of cancer when I got my second diagnosis of the disease in 2014, but it made the news somewhat less scary to handle, with fewer unknowns. By then, life had taught me some valuable lessons that were less than pleasant to learn. Many cancer memoirs are dedicated to staunchly supportive spouses, but not the one I've written about my own experiences. My Wild Ride: How to Thrive After Breast Cancer and Infidelity, released in 2022. If you have breast cancer and your husband doesn't know how to cope, or worse, is unfaithful, he can be more of a millstone than a rock. The more I talked with other breast cancer patients, the more I heard that even loving and well-meaning husbands might have great difficulty dealing with their partner's illness. For me, cancer on top of a cheating husband, gave me the incentive to make changes and ensure that whatever lifespan I had left would be more fulfilling. I wouldn't deal with cancer as a quietly suffering saint. That wasn't my style. I would make sure my own needs came first. I was going to be a sarcastic cow and milk the hell out of my ludicrous situation. Wow, I said to myself, look at it this way. I now had the chance to take about 6 months off without the hassle of having to deal with foreign travel. Of course, for any cancer patient, that assumes you can afford not to work while you are undergoing treatment and your enlightened employer is keeping your job open for you. I was fortunate to be able to take as much time off as I needed. Perhaps I could catch up on all the books I'd wanted to read and the films I missed. I might even lose weight without the expense of going to a health spa or fat farm. I also had the perfect excuse to drop any tasks I didn't like doing. Easy enough, apart from the minor detail of having to find someone else both capable and willing to do them. Being sick can be quite a time-consuming business, and I might find that I had less free time than I expected. But who knows? Maybe being busy with all that would make the process feel like it was going by faster. So off I went on a wild adventure, chemoed, nuked, stripped bald, and bewigged, as well as planning what I would do if the cancer turned terminal. I had two main weapons to fight off the assaults on my body, mind, and emotions. First of all, an eye for absurdity, based on a British upbringing filled with a razor-sharp wit of Monty Python. Secondly, as a former BBC reporter, I had an investigative journalist's anal attention to detail, researching everything to the nth degree, taking nothing for granted, and asking plenty of questions. I refused to be a victim. I wouldn't give up sex. I wouldn't give up swimming. I wouldn't give up chocolate. Having a potential death sentence made me examine my life and decide what was important to me. I was going to take charge of my illness and use it as an opportunity to live the life I wanted, despite any brutal difficulties. I would keep assessing and evaluating the best ways to get healthy, both conventional and alternative. Nothing would be off the table. In this chapter, I discuss some of the options I faced and what I decided to do, but that doesn't mean my choices are suitable for someone else's circumstances. I have no medical training, so I'm not a replacement for the advice of a doctor. I've read plenty of cancer literature, and some of it has been irritatingly preachy, so I've tried to avoid that. According to the American Cancer Society, the 5-year survival rate of women with non-metastatic early-stage breast cancer is close to 100%. That being said, cancer can be a crapshoot. Whatever treatment anyone undergoes, whether conventional, alternative, or both, there are no guarantees. Choosing how to deal with the disease is a very personal decision. Since I'd had breast cancer twice, once on each side, as well as having the BRCA2 gene, I have to admit that several of my friends, relatives, and probably my surgeon too, thought I was completely nuts to refuse mastectomies. When I had a routine visit to my breast cancer surgeon in 2013, having been cancer-free for 6 years, she suggested I'd be better off going the Angelina Jolie route. No way in hell am I doing that, was my response. I didn't want to turn my boobs into unnatural numb lumps of silicone or whatever else they would stuff inside them. In addition, I'd heard horror stories about post-mastectomy pain, edema, and both diminished strength and range of motion in the arms. I was also concerned about getting implants that might become misshapen or leak. A year later, I was diagnosed with a new cancer in the other breast. Again, I refused to have any mastectomies and opted for another lumpectomy. By then, a few of my friends had come down with full-blown breast implant illness from silicone implants, suffering various health problems related to toxicity, immune, autoimmune, neurological, endocrine, and metabolic dysfunction. Their symptoms disappeared after having those implants surgically removed. That's why some women I knew decided to steer clear of reconstruction surgery altogether and go flat after mastectomies rather than having implants. Might I have avoided having to deal with a second tumor if I had agreed to prophylactic mastectomies earlier? Whatever the answer is to that question, I still do not regret deciding to hang on to my breasts. Let's hope my tombstone won't read, "Here lies CJ Grace because she refused to lop off her boobs." When Angelina Jolie's BRCA gene story appeared in the press in 2013, I felt there should have been much more coverage of the ovarian cancer risks faced by those with BRCA gene mutations, rather than focusing only on breast cancer and prophylactic mastectomies. When my gene profile was discovered, I was advised to have my ovaries removed, but I wanted to wait till I'd gone through menopause to avoid being slammed into it artificially. Instead, I regularly had an ultrasound of my ovaries and the CA125 blood test. This measures a particular cancer antigen protein that is elevated in most ovarian cancer cases, but there are several other conditions that can cause a high reading, so the test is only recommended for those with a high risk of ovarian cancer. 2 years after my first breast cancer diagnosis, I went to a relative's wedding and got talking with an old friend of the family. She told me about three women she knew who had recovered well from breast cancer, but some years later had all died from ovarian tumors. It was a wake-up call for me to get rid of my ovaries and fallopian tubes, which for some reason is known as an oophorectomy. By the time I went under the knife, I'd already reached menopause, and after the operation, I noticed little difference in how I felt. Angelina Jolie wasn't so lucky. In 2015, at the age of 39, her CA125 blood test showed anomalies that might indicate an ovarian tumor, so she had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed. Jolie's mother also had a defective BRCA1 gene and was diagnosed with breast cancer. However, it was an ovarian tumor that killed her. Even though I took the standard route of chemotherapy and radiation, I combined it with various alternative methods, including supplements, acupuncture, homeopathy, osteopathy, qigong, intravenous ozone, vitamin C infusions, and resonant frequencies. My goal was to reduce not only the side effects of conventional treatment, but also the likelihood of my cancer returning. I was bombarded with a great deal of unsolicited advice about how my treatment choices were wrong and that I should be doing something else from well-meaning but annoying people. One or two of them seemed to act like fire and brimstone preachers, as if I would not only die but also go to hell if I ignored their recommendations. People have very strong views about alternative versus allopathic medicine, getting as worked up and evangelical about the subject as folks do about politics and religion. When I sent out a bulk email to my social circle, including one line about how my naturopath friend was working his magic to reduce the side effects I was having from the chemo treatment, one of my more hard-line anti-alternative medicine friends responded angrily, "Naturopathy is quackery, pure and simple. Naturopaths are full of crap. Self-delusion is their standard, not evidence. I'm sorry that you're being taken in by this nonsense." Then, as an afterthought, he added, "I'm glad you're doing well." This was my response. Thanks for your candour. Obviously, the placebo effect is working well, as my radiologist complained to me that I was looking too healthy and not sick enough from my chemo treatment. She was worried that I was doing something that was reducing the effectiveness of the chemo. Since all my hair everywhere has fallen out, I'm assuming that the chemo has definitely worked its way throughout my body. I think my radiologist was basing her opinions on the fact that when you're doing radiation, you aren't supposed to have any antioxidants, such as vitamin C, as they do impair the treatment. But according to my oncologist, that's not the case when undergoing chemotherapy. All the best, severely deluded. Other friends berated me for undergoing conventional treatment. Chemo and radiation are toxic and don't work, one of them insisted. Another told me to give up dairy or else my cancer would return with a vengeance. No can do. As a Brit, having milk in my tea, real milk and not some fake soy, oat or almond milk concoction, is something I would find just too difficult to give up. One person, who shall remain nameless to protect his reputation, angrily declared that the reason I got cancer was because I was too tense and needed to relax. If his aim was to help me relax, shouting at me was not an effective method to achieve this. Naturally, I felt somewhat stressed out and negative at times during the treatment process, a common story for many cancer patients. However, amazingly, I'm still alive, at least while reading this to you. Nevertheless, I was shocked at my second cancer diagnosis. I thought I'd been living a healthy life. I could feel quite smug and superior when I compared myself to other people. I was careful about what I ate. I exercised regularly every day. I kept my weight down. I'd just begun a brand new relationship which seemed to be going well. I'd maintained a positive attitude and a sense of humour. So why the hell had I got breast cancer again? Why me? Who or what was to blame? Was it my cheating husband? Some friends and therapists would insist that emotional stress and or lack of love was the root cause. The more I would hear this apparently earth-shattering revelation, the more it would make me want to sigh and roll my eyes. I couldn't undo my husband's infidelity. My life wasn't a video that I could rewind to go back to an earlier place in the story. I didn't want to do that anyway. I was quite happy being apart from him. I enjoyed the fact that I was free to do whatever I wanted. But getting breast cancer again without the security of a supportive, committed spouse shook me to my foundations. The world was no longer my oyster. Was my fledgling relationship with a lovely new man now doomed? After all, who would want to date a pallid, hairless ghoul with slashed breasts? I felt I should be auditioning for a role in a zombie movie rather than getting romantically involved with someone. Yet the relationship thrived despite my illness. Most likely, emotional stress had contributed to my cancer, probably combined with a number of other factors. In many ways, the reason was irrelevant. I would never know exactly why my cancer had happened. I just had to put one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward to deal with the disease. Various studies I'd read seemed to show that practically everything gives you cancer. Perhaps the best shot a person has at being away from carcinogens is to live in a remote place with no pollution and no stress. Easy to do, right? Maybe subsisting on grass and bugs. Sounds like fun? There's also no way to run from the main risk factor for breast cancer, growing older. Aside from aging, here are just a few things that I heard allegedly may cause cancer. Stress, especially bereavement, bankruptcy, divorce, and moving out of your home. A sedentary job and lack of exercise. Defective genes, random mutations, negative emotions, loneliness, having low socioeconomic status, inflammation, hormone replacement therapy, known as HRT, obesity, alcohol, cigarettes, vaping, eating late in the evening, wearing bras, especially those with underwires, bioengineered or genetically modified organisms, also known as GMOs, food irradiation, eggs, meat, red meat, seafood, fish, bruised fruit, nightshades, such as eggplants and potatoes, viruses, bacteria, mold, fungi, aflatoxins, commonly found in peanut butter, parasites, sugar, artificial sweeteners, dairy, casein, lectins in beans, wheat, and tomatoes, for example, gluten, plastic bottles, plastic microbeads in toothpaste and cosmetics, pesticides, herbicides, especially glyphosate, non-organic food, processed food, food colouring, food additives, seed oils, trans fats, also known as hydrogenated vegetable oils, preservatives, nitrites, smoked meats, air fresheners, cleaning products, cosmetics, shampoos and conditioners. Good thing I didn't need those for a while when I was doing chemo. Propylene glycol, polyethylene glycol, PABA, phthalates, parabens, sodium lauryl sulfate, formaldehyde, synthetic fabrics and carpeting, sunscreen. It's supposed to prevent skin cancer, but may contain nanoparticles and chemicals that are carcinogenic. Barbecuing, frying, acrylamides, found in French fries, potato chips, and burnt toast, as well as cigarette smoke. Air pollution, biomass burning, contaminated water, chlorinated water, arsenic, often detected in rice, especially if it's been cultivated where cotton was previously grown. Cadmium, lead. Sadly for me as a chocoholic, both cadmium and lead have been found in chocolate and cocoa powder. Copper, aluminum, mercury, metal fillings, dental implants, root canals, tooth and gum infections, aluminum foil, aluminum cookware, non-stick cookware, microwaves, electromagnetic fields, also known as EMFs, especially 5G signals, cell phones, cell towers, wireless internet, vaccines, antibiotics, prescription drugs, recreational drugs, mammograms, good for screening and early detection, but some claim they're bad because they emit ionizing radiation and can spread cancer by squeezing the breasts, gadolinium-based MRI contrast agents, and chemotherapy. Yes, the chemo that's supposed to kill your cancer cells may give you a secondary cancer later on. Then there are the after effects of the 2011 nuclear power station disaster at Fukushima, not to mention your local radioactive waste dump. The list goes on. Breast cancer is drearily common. In 2014, along with TV celebrities Samantha Harris and Joan London, I was one of nearly 300,000 people in America diagnosed with the disease. Perhaps instead of asking, why me? A better question might have been, how come it took this long for me to get cancer? I'd already written a humorous self-help book, Adulterer's Wife, How to Thrive Whether You Stay or Not, inspired by having had to deal with an unfaithful husband. Once I decided to write a candid comic memoir and survival guide based on my breast cancer journey, I did a huge amount of research on the subject. I looked at the whole gamut of both conventional and alternative treatments. One friend told me about an attempt by an alternative MD to cure her abdominal pain, which was actually colon cancer, by playing the didgeridoo to get rid of an entity he claimed was inside her. Not surprisingly, this technique failed. The patient then went to her local ER, had surgery to remove the tumour, and thankfully lived to tell the tale. Thus, I was somewhat sceptical when I heard that the link between wearing a bra and breast cancer is stronger than that between smoking and lung cancer. Bras are worse than cigarettes? Surely not. The issue was brought to light by medical anthropologist Sidney Ross Singer in a book that he and his wife Soma Grismeyer wrote in 1994 and revised in 2018, with the unforgettable title Dressed to Kill: The Link Between Breast Cancer and Bras. I bought a copy and, to my amazement, found the evidence they presented to be compelling. The authors don't deny that toxins in the modern environment play a major part in creating cancer in humans. However, toxins collect in fatty tissue in the body. And where do all we women have fatty tissue? In our breasts. Normally, waste products and toxins would be flushed out by the lymphatic system, but a bra compresses the breasts and sides of the body near the armpits. The garment also constricts the shoulders, where the straps tend to dig in, and squeezes the area underneath the breast, particularly if an underwire bra is worn. All this compression, according to Singer and Grismeyer, blocks lymph flow, so that the toxins stay in the breast, which leads to pain, cysts, and tumour growth. Bras also heat up the breast tissue, which apparently also causes cancer. From 1991 to 1993, Singer and Grismeyer carried out the Bra and Breast Cancer Study, in which 4,730 women from 5 cities in the US were interviewed about their bra usage. Roughly half the group had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Singer reports this study concluded that bra-free women have about the same risk of breast cancer as men. While the tighter and longer the bra is worn, the higher the risk becomes. Up to 125 times higher for a 24/7 bra user compared to a bra-free woman. Singer and Grismeyer also did research in Fiji, where they say there was apparently no breast cancer at all until women began to wear Western clothing, particularly in the workplace. The Fijian women who began wearing brassieres were the ones who later were diagnosed with breast cancer. I wondered whether the underwire in a bra might also cause problems by acting as an antenna to attract electromagnetic fields, also known as EMF, a possibility that is briefly mentioned in Dressed to Kill. This speculation of mine arose from a bizarre turn of events many years ago when my primary school-aged youngest son, Arthur, was fitted with orthodontic headgear and wore it at night for the first time. The next morning, he told me he was terrified and had been having horrible nightmares. He was convinced that an evil monster had taken up residence in his closet. The following morning, Arthur declared that the nasty entity was still there. Some ghost hunters insist that you can detect such supernatural phenomena by looking for areas of EMF activity. So, on the third night, before my son was about to go to bed, I checked out his room with an EMF meter. There was no EMF activity in his closet. But I detected very high readings in a straight line across the ceiling, right by his bed. I later discovered that these high readings only appeared when his brother, whose bedroom was adjoining, had his computer turned on. I theorized that the wire in my son's orthodontic headgear had become a receiver for EMF from the electrical wiring in the ceiling, which had created a disturbance that his brain had interpreted as a monster in the closet. I had to make sure that his brother's computer was turned off in the evening to ensure that Arthur got a good night's sleep with no more nightmares while he was wearing the headgear. So as far as my health was concerned, the last thing I wanted to do was to continue to create an environment for cancer to thrive again. But was I ready to burn my bras? I'd been conditioned from youth to wear them. I remember how proud I was when I got my first training bra, with practically nothing there to fill its cups. Later, when I was an adult working in an office setting, it felt very unprofessional to go braless. I first decided to avoid underwire bras, even though they do seem to do a better job of holding things up than those without them. However, soon I was finding that the underwire style felt too tight and uncomfortable to wear. Many women sleep in a bra, and research seems to show that the more hours the garment is worn, the greater the breast cancer risk. So I made sure that whatever I wore in bed was loose and unconstricting. No tight, sexy negligee. Instead, I went for the frumpy grandma look and could have fitted a whole family inside my nightgown. These days, if I'm out doing something work-oriented, I may wear gel petals to cover my nipples, but I prefer going completely braless. Sadly, mainstream cancer groups have not only ignored the incriminating data against bras, but actively denied it. They have trumpeted a study done in 2014 that showed no link between bras and cancer. This research included only postmenopausal women, whom other studies have shown to be less dramatically affected by bra usage than premenopausal women. And more importantly, there was no control group of women who did not wear bras. That's like studying the relationship between smoking and lung cancer without including any non-smokers to compare to the smokers. It was obvious to me why this debunking study was done. Cancer is an extremely lucrative business for doctors, medical institutions, and the pharmaceutical industry. If you happen to have a competing cure for cancer, particularly if it is non-patentable, organizations such as the FDA are likely to send a SWAT team over to your establishment and shut you down faster than if you had a meth lab in your basement. Over the millennia and across the globe, those in power have rarely let people's welfare stand in the way of a good profit. When I research alternative health topics online, I tend to use the search engines DuckDuckGo, SwissCows, or Brave rather than Google because, at least at the time of writing this chapter, the results appear to be more unbiased. Many people in the complementary medicine community say that Google is not only deliberately disparaging their methods, but also censoring and downgrading their websites so that they don't appear anywhere near the top pages of search results. This has been borne out by my own experience. Alternative cancer therapies that I was able to research on Google when I had my first case of breast cancer in 2007 became increasingly more difficult to find in online searches 7 years later and up to the present after I got the disease again in 2014. After losing several family members to cancer, Ty and Charlene Bollinger, a devout Christian couple from Texas, have made it their life's mission to research alternative cancer therapies around the world. They've been vilified in the mainstream media for spreading misinformation and quackery. While I don't agree with everything the Bollingers say in their documentaries and books, they report on various non-toxic treatments that appear to have been proven effective. If, God forbid, I were to be diagnosed with terminal cancer and my allopathic doctor could do nothing for me, I would have nothing to lose by looking into these alternative therapies, some of which are only available outside the USA. If I could wave a magic wand and make the breast cancer and infidelity never have happened, would I do it? You might be surprised to hear me say no. Today, I don't regret having gone through the experience of infidelity and cancer, bleak and difficult though it was. I'm actually grateful to my ex and his girlfriend. Forgiving them means they don't occupy real estate in my head. I've got much better things to think about these days. I used to help my husband produce his books. Now I've written my own books, comic self-help ones about infidelity, Adulterer's Wife, How to Thrive Whether You Stay or Not, published in 2016, and Breast Cancer,
My Wild Ride, How to Thrive After Breast Cancer and Infidelity, released in 2022. Regret is not about the past. It's about the present, and I'm happy with my life as it is now. If I hadn't gone through the past exactly as it was, my here and now would be different. Cancer and the breakup of my marriage have made me viscerally understand the impermanence of life. I cannot take things for granted. Nothing makes you feel more alive than when the icy breath of death brushes across your cheek. Nothing makes you cherish every moment, every sunset, every human connection more than an embrace from the dark side.